Hello, and welcome to the Empowerography Podcast. This is a platform created for women's voices to be heard and a place to share their stories, journeys, and successes with the world for the purpose of helping other women who might be on similar journeys. We are empowering women one episode at a time. I'm your host, Brad Walsh, so kick back, grab one of your favorite beverages, and enjoy the stories. The world needs to hear your message and your story, so don't deny the world of that gift within you that the universe has given you. Someone out there needs to hear your story because it will support them in feeling hope, inspired, and even transformed. Do you want to discover how I help get my clients out of their own way, show up, and confidently share their message? I would love to extend an invitation to you to join me in my free masterclass, Start Your Own Podcast from Idea to Implementation, on Wednesday, April 5th at 1 p.m. Eastern. You can find the registry link in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Hello there, Brad Walsh here, your host of the Empowerography Podcast. Today, my guest is Molly McDonald. She is the founder of the Pink Fund, a contributing writer for Breast Cancer Wellness Magazine, a passionate patient advocate, and a keynote speaker. Last but certainly not least, a mother. Molly, welcome. I am so honored and happy to have you here today. Thank you so much for taking and making the time to be here with me today. I appreciate you. How are you doing?
Well, as I've mentioned earlier, we've had a role reversal in our family. 18 years ago, when I was in treatment for breast cancer, my husband was the caregiver. And now he is the patient in treatment for cancer, and I'm the caregiver. And we have very, I would say, divergent coping mechanisms. Having been a Girl Scout, my motto is be prepared. So I attended the largest North American Global Cancer Conference in Chicago in June called ASCO, which stands for the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And of course, went to every head and neck, because he has tonsil cancer, every head and neck meeting I could, and came back with some dire predictions right here. And so that has been quite interesting. So I think he's in the denial of things, like, I don't need to know about it until it happens. And I'm in the, I want to know every possible iteration scenario, and I need to be prepared for that to happen. And I told him, so I think I told you he's my third husband, which is kind of embarrassing, except the first two kind of broke those forsaking all others vows. Now we're in that last vow of in sickness and in health. Back to the in sickness and in health part with the other two. They didn't last long enough. So now I'm at the in sickness and in health until death do you part. And I'm thinking, am I going to have a fourth husband? So
here's to hoping no.
Clearly, I haven't particularly successful at being married. We've been together 21 years, so that's good.
That's something for sure. Yeah. With all of this being said, I would love for you to share with us, let's start this off with, what is the Pink Fund all about, and when did you found the company?
So in the spring of 2005, I had a surprise breast cancer diagnosis at a time of job transition. And while I was in active treatment, I met a lot of other working women who had experienced what I was experiencing, which was loss of income and concern around how long their treatment protocol was going to last and how long their savings or inability to work was going to allow them to adhere to their treatment as prescribed. So in my particular case, the challenge for me was I had been through a financially devastating divorce with five children. I had no alimony, irregular child support, and like many Americans, less than $1,000 cash on hand for an emergency. So on top of that, I had a $1,300 a month COBRA premium, which in the US allows you, if you're transitioning between jobs, to maintain your health insurance policy. And this was pre the Affordable Care Act, so I was not eligible for our social health insurance policy known as Medicaid here. So I had to make this COBRA premium of $1,300 a month to ensure my care. But the really shocking piece for me was listening to these other women who were actually going to stop treatment and go back to work. So while we experienced what was now coined financial toxicity in 2013 by two doctors, Yusuf Safar and Amy Abernethy from Duke University, we were experiencing this 8 years prior to it even being a known side effect, something that wasn't being addressed at the time. So our home was in foreclosure. I was at risk for a vehicle repossession, utility shutoffs, ended up in line at the food bank. And then remarkably, I thought, in spite of my very clear and prescient circumstances, that I should do something about this.
Right.
So I went home to my husband, Tom Terrific. That's what I call him, because you have to be you have to be really terrific to marry a middle-aged woman with night sweats, five children, and a mildly demented mother. Or insane. So that's his moniker, Tom Terrific. So I went home and I said, Tom, we need to start this charity and we need to pay these women's non-medical bills to their creditors so they can finish their treatment. And he looked at me like I had two heads and said, yeah, because we just rescued the house from foreclosure and you're in line at the food bank. What makes you think we can do this? And I said, well, I don't know. I just believe I can. And being from Detroit, Michigan, Henry Ford said, whether you think you can or you can't, you're right.
Yeah.
And there must be some kind of magic around that, the magical thinking. There's a lot written about the biology of belief. So yeah. I don't know. I just thought I could. And because he sleeps with me, he went along with it.
Wow. It's incredible. You just finished rescuing your house from foreclosure. You're having to pay out $1,300 a month for your transitioning, for your treatments. And you take on this monumental task of helping other women pay their medical bill.
Yeah. That is,
I can't even imagine what was going through Tom's head when you first brought that home.
Well, and right. Well, as I said, he sleeps with me, so it was there on the couch. So he had watched me pull rabbits out of hats in the past.
Right.
So I think he had confidence that if I thought I could do it, he would help me do it. And he had helped me in the past do some things that looked like it wouldn't happen. So he did go along with it. And fast forward to today, we're a national organization having delivered just over, I think we're about $7.2 million in bill payments directly to patients' creditors nationwide for housing, transportation, utilities, and insurance.
That is incredible. And that's got to really fill your heart when you look back at that day, on that day of when you came home and said, Tom, this is what we're doing, to where you are now, to have helped fund $7.2 million worth to help. That is absolutely incredible. I think, one, that speaks to your incredible resilience and strength and courage, but also speaks to how beautiful your partnership is with Tom and his belief in you and his support in your ideas. I think that is absolutely beautiful and incredible. That is a huge testament.
Our partnership is quite so beautiful right now as I'm bossing him around, but
I'm sure he probably does not feel that too.
Right. He doesn't. This is really kind of funny and off topic, but Tom is probably the nicest man I've ever known and very kind and never says a bad thing to anybody. But a couple of weeks ago, I asked him a question. He said, you are asking stupid questions. And I'm like, what? There are no stupid questions. So I think he's kind of had it with me a bit. But
I think it speaks to how beautiful your partnership is. I really do.
Yeah. I'm really fortunate to have him. He is the true co-founder of this organization. I have taken all the credit for the last 17 years that we've been running this show together. And it's time now for me to tell the truth. He's the co-founder. And I didn't do this alone.
So, Molly, could you tell us a little bit about your role and duties within the Pink Fund now, as opposed to when you first founded the company? How have they changed over the years with the growing awareness of the business and the work you're doing?
So in the beginning, it was Tom and me. So we launched on October 2nd, 2012. We got a donated website. I had traded a what's called an Eero-Saren, and many people are into mid-century modern now, so it's called a tulip table. I had that, and I traded it with the graphic designer for a heart and ribbon logo. And then the medical writer at the Detroit Free Press, where I'd been an executive, wrote a front-page story about our efforts, and 27 newspapers picked it up. So the first 6 years, we are just kind of eking along. I did a lot of speaking engagements for free, you know, any Kiwanis, Rotary, Optimist, church, synagogue, men's groups, ladies groups, whatever, that wanted an inspirational speaker. I would go in and tell sort of my riches to rags story. So a little bit about my backstory. Yeah. I was married to a very wealthy, successful man, Harvard educated lawyer, who lost all our money, and I had to leave and take my children in 1997 and start over, return to work after being out of the workforce 12 years, and was cobbling together a lot of income. I transitioned these kids from private to public school. There was a dramatic change in our lifestyle. But in any case, Tom and I, with the support of people who sort of thought we could do this, because again, as I said, we just rescued the home from foreclosure, and I had no personal money of my own to fund this, and I wasn't going to go and sort of fleece my own former very wealthy friends, because again, who thought I could do this? That was the other thing. A lot of people would look at me when I would tell them what I wanted to do, like I was insane. So we bootstrapped the whole thing. And then by 2012, Ford Motor Company picked us up and took us national. So I made a vision board in 2007. I put Ford on it. They have a program called Warriors in Pink. And I knew that the problem we were addressing here in Michigan was not relegated to a particular state. So I wanted us to be able to be a national organization, but we would need a partner to make that happen. And at that time, Ford was, to my knowledge, the largest partner in the breast cancer space, providing millions of dollars of support solely to Susan G. Komen. But in 2012, we were still operating out of my home. We had just, by the spring of 2012, we had been given donated office space, and we had hired a part-time program manager to manage the actual execution of reviewing patient applications for support, paying their creditors. I was out speaking and raising money. So 2012, she was employed. I think the board at that point, because we were all volunteer until the board voted me a salary in 2012. It actually got to the point where I was fired from a job because I was doing speaking engagements during my lunch hour and weekends, and my employer didn't like it.
Wow.
Which was curious, because that was in the mortgage industry. And I thought that was a benefit to this particular employer, but he didn't see it that way. So that's when I went to the board and said, okay, I've been doing this 6 years as a volunteer. So this is a pivotal point. We either have to sundown this, which means shut the doors, close it, or you need to hire me, or you need to hire somebody else, because I have to have a job. I have these kids and I have to have an income. So they voted me enough of a stipend that with the child support I was now receiving, I could eat through. So that was 2012. Ford picks us up, takes us national, everything changes. We went from maybe providing, and it's on our website, I'm trying to think, our budget in 2012 was $168,000, and I think we gave away somewhere around $70,000 that year. But the next year, we jumped to like 200 and some thousand in support. So
wow.
Ford's belief in our organization was nothing short of miraculous. What we were doing was completely different than what Komen was doing in research. So it wasn't competitive at all. And we're now in the 11th year of that partnership.
Incredible. So that was the catalyst moment for mm-hmm. the Pink Fund.
And then now you ask what I do now. This mm-hmm. So now we have scaled to the point that we have 13 employees, between 10 employees and 3 contractors. And I don't know everything anymore. And that is a really weird feeling. So we have a development department that raises the money to support the mission. Then we have the program department that delivers the mission. And then we have operations. And then we have accounting, like everything, all the legal stuff, IT, and marketing. So it's an odd position to have grown an organization where you're not in the weeds every day. You're
doing
a lot of oversight. So right now, of that team, 3 of those people report directly to me, and then the people they supervise report to them. But we're a very collaborative team. They're really invested in the mission, which is amazing. And we have a lot of fun together.
That's it. I think that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. Now, as a breast cancer survivor yourself and an advocate, you've experienced a journey filled with challenges and resilience. Can you share a little bit about your own personal story and journey and some of the most significant lessons you learned throughout your personal experience on the breast cancer journey?
Well, I think the first lesson I would say that's interesting, probably for anybody in any disease state, once you sort of are what I call rushed into the sorority or fraternity that nobody wants to be in. It's once you're in, there's a lot of support from other people who understand what you're going through, which is really a lovely thing, because when somebody is ill, family and friends don't know what to say. I mean, I was talking to somebody about my husband's diagnosis, and they told me, yeah, well, my dad had that and he died 4 months later. You know, people don't know what to say. And the other day, a neighbor came over and said, I didn't want to tell you when we were walking, but my aunt had that. And she was sick for 5 years and had a feeding tube and was on oxygen and died. And so I'm going to call this sisterhood or brotherhood, this fraternity, sorority of like-minded people who understand what you're going through is great. Go back to the question again, because I kind of got off.
Just share a little bit about the lessons that you've learned through
That was one that I'm still in contact with the people that I was in a support group with 18 years ago through the provider where I was. So the other lesson that I've learned is there are challenges when you're growing an organization. And so I've had, I would say, three significant challenges. The first one is I started my organization in 2005 under a different name with the support at my request of my breast surgeon and my girlfriend. And within the year, I was going out and speaking and we were raising money. And the two of them set up a board of directors and would not allow me to sit on the board. And I was completely confused by that. What I didn't realize is that it is my belief that I was so good at speaking that the other two were being, and this is personal because I don't have any real, maybe overshadowed by my personality. So at one point I expressed some concern around conflict of interest, and I don't want to go into what those were, but I felt that they were significant. And within a couple of weeks of expressing that concern, my husband was present when we had that discussion. I received a courier delivered letter from them and their board severing their relationship with me and taking my organization as theirs.
Wow.
So this was when you talked about resilience, I was more horrified than when I found out that my children's father had lost all our money and that our big, beautiful home was going to be auctioned off at a sheriff's sale in 30 days. I mean, the rug was pulled out from under me. It was shocking that this individual who had taken an oath to do no harm and cut me open in the front, essentially, in the back. However, in retrospect, I just don't think it was a good fit for any of us, right? So I think that I was freed from that, but it did not feel like that at the time. So it was a Friday in August, and I mixed up a very large pitcher of Cosmopolitan cocktails and got blasted drunk and felt really bad the next day. But by Monday, I decided to start over. And so my husband came up with the name Pink Fund. And I think that was around August 26th, something around like that. I'd have to look up the letter. But literally by October 2nd, we rebooted.
Incredible.
So that's one instance of resilience. Another one is our first board of directors were people that they were friends because nobody really believed that I could do what I wanted to do. And my husband, you know, we were really small. So it was me, my husband, the graphic designer, and these two other women that were friends. And the two other women voted my husband off the board and then harassed the graphic designer to the point that she resigned from the board and then created a situation where it looked like there was going to be what I call a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
And at that point, I came home, and there were some other things that were happening. One of those individuals signed a contract, which violated the bylaws, which actually a contract for office space, which we could not afford. And that violated the bylaws and actually put her in a situation of being financially responsible for that contract. So Tom found a real estate attorney who got us out from under it and a nonprofit consultant who basically pulled everybody together and outlined what had happened and the timeline and how it violated the bylaws and what the exposure was to this one individual who promptly resigned from the board. But during that time, I realized that they were going to take over like the same thing that happened to me five years earlier. And again, those things I think are driven by ego and desire to have something for yourself that, you know, is a great idea, but was not your idea. So during that time, I came home to Tom and it was so stressful. I had a full-time job at the time and these emails were flying back and forth. And I just came home and I said, you know what, this is not worth it. I'm quitting. And he just looked at me and he said, well, if you're quitting, then you're not the right woman for the job, because if this little thing is troubling you, then you're not going to be able to handle the big stuff. So step aside.
Wow.
Right. So that pissed me off. So I didn't step aside. And Tom, because of his due diligence and support, was able to resolve it all. And then we moved forward. And then we had our next board was a much more professional board. And I share these things, by the way, not to disparage these individuals, but to share stories of resilience and lessons that hopefully other people can learn if they're thinking about building a nonprofit. Who do you align yourself with? Try to find out what their motive is to be in your space, especially as you're building a board of directors. We have a great board now. They're amazing. But in the second iteration of the board, we had some great people, but one of them was a litigator. And she would hold the board meetings over and argue over every point. She would come into the meetings as if she was going to trial with papers, briefcases, and files, and stuff was redacted. I don't know why it was redacted, but anyway, at one point, we had 3 resignations from the board because of that behavior. Nobody wanted to sit in a board meeting for 4 hours with someone who was arguing. We basically, our board meetings are quarterly, and this is what we've achieved, and these are our challenges, and this is our budget versus actual, and this is our profit and loss, and these are new opportunities, and that's kind of it. So in that instance, I took this individual out and shared with her that what made her really amazing in the courtroom did not make her amazing in the boardroom.
Yeah. That
the boardroom is about collaboration, and the courtroom is about win and lose.
Yeah.
And in nonprofits, it's not win and lose. So that was interesting, and she rolled off the board. But I did ask for her resignation, and she became litigious. And so she just asked if she could roll off at the end of her term. So those were really hard challenges for me. Interestingly enough, I'm pretty confrontational with like my kids or my husband. In business, I'm not. I have trouble. I really don't like confrontation in business. I learned to do it.
Interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
Breast cancer can obviously have a tremendous impact on an individual's mental and emotional well-being. How did you navigate the emotional roller coaster that comes along with that diagnosis? And what strategies did you find most helpful during that time for you?
Well, the diagnosis and the treatment was nothing compared to the financial toxicity of thinking we could possibly be homeless. So again, be prepared. I pulled back on everything that we didn't have to spend money on. We had a car, like a third car that was kind of the kid's car. We sold that. I cut everybody's hair. I groomed the dog. At that time, there was Blockbuster. We didn't do Blockbuster. We didn't shop for clothing. I mean, I remember I had a budget for everything. And so that was the greatest mental stress. And at one point, I had taken out $500,000 life insurance policy on my life when I left my children's father in the event that I would pass away and they needed financial resources. And at one point that summer, I began to think that my children would be better off without me because we were facing losing our home and I didn't have a job. And I was still under a tax lien because my former husband had his office manager forge my signature on income tax and he didn't pay it. So I still was dealing with that. So, you know, I couldn't own anything. The house that we were living in, I rented for cash, and then my mother at 80 procured a 30-year mortgage so the kids and I wouldn't be homeless on the condition that we would make the payments.
Wow.
Right. So we were in a very precarious situation, and I don't know that I didn't cope very well. I was very tired from the radiation, so I was sleeping a lot, but I was terrified. I was terrified that we were going to be homeless. I mean, my coping mechanisms now are practicing yoga, walking 45 minutes to an hour every day. I used to swim, but that was taking too much time. And prayer, I would say prayer. That's kind of what they are now. And then, of course, I told you earlier that I'm having 2 glasses of wine every night. My doctor, we had this woman on our board. She's a nurse. She says, you know, when someone tells you they're having 2 glasses of wine every night, they're lying. And I said, what do you mean? She said, they're drinking the whole bottle. She said, that's just what they'll admit to. I have an amazing staff that loves me like family. So that's fabulous. My parents are long deceased and my sister left Michigan, gosh, maybe 50 years. It couldn't be 50 years. Yeah, it could be maybe 50 years ago or more. And I always say she got as far away as she could from us without leaving the country. So she lives on an island in the Pacific Northwest. And so I don't see her very often.
Right. And so for individuals currently facing a breast cancer diagnosis, the journey ahead, obviously, as you went through, can be incredibly overwhelming and filled with uncertainty. So what advice would you give to someone in that position, considering your experience and insights?
So I think at the time you get a diagnosis, many of us will Google. Doctors will tell you don't Google. Well, we're going to Google anyway. I think seeking a second opinion is a really good idea. Getting in a support group, whether that's a private Facebook group or a person-to-person. During COVID, it all had to be virtual anyway. But I think, as I said in the beginning of the program, being with our own kind, so to speak, is very soothing, where you can really express what you're afraid of, and other people may be afraid of the same thing. They give great advice. There are so many groups out there for young women. There's the Young Survival Coalition and the Breasties. For women of color, there's TOUCH, the Black Breast Cancer Alliance, and the Tiger Lily Foundation, and the Sisters Network. I think it's really important to be in the company of those people. Now, that said, because there's such a high recurrence of breast cancer, so 30% of us will recur and become what's called metastatic, which means the cancer has left the breast and entered the vital organs, bones, brain, and you live with it until you die from it. There are amazing groups for those women as well. And so I would say that's first and foremost. I do think nutrition is important. If you've been a fast food, I mean, that's one of the hard things. Nutrition is really important, that you keep your nutrition up. If you can, a daily walk of 30 minutes at least, yoga, meditation, and a lot of these things can be done in the privacy of your home, which doesn't mean you don't have to join a health club. I think those things are all really important. And then finally, hope. You cannot quantify or qualify what hope does for you. That because there's such a high survival rate, in spite of the 30% risk of recurrence, the treatment can be toxic and challenging and discouraging, but you watch people come out of it. So I guess that's my best advice. Then on the financial side, I think it's really important that the time of diagnosis, if you're concerned about inability to work or you're high deductible, you need to ask if there's a financial counselor in the provider setting to talk to about how you're going to manage this. And the challenge is that your physician is not going to know what this is going to cost. If you say, I don't know, what is this all going to cost me in the end? They don't know. So you have to find somebody who does know. And then if payment is going to be a problem, the first thing I recommend is setting up a payment plan. So they'll base that based on your income. And in my case, it took me 3 years to pay off the provider. I paid $100 a month. I had a very low deductible. This was $2,005, but I had no money and I didn't want my bill to go into collections. So you don't want to avoid that. So I think making a payment plan, whatever it is, and as long as you make that plan and you stick to it, they're not going to send that bill to collections. And finally, if you are in a nonprofit, federally funded hospital, there's an organization called Dollar Four that can help you deal with any debt that you might have, because that has to be dismissed legally. Okay. So there are organizations that can help with that. And then if you need copay assistance for your medications, provided you fall within, sometimes it's 300 to 400% of the federal poverty level, there are a number of organizations that can help with that. And so that then you have to sit with a social worker or a patient navigator. And that can really all help ease the burden. And then the other thing is cut yourself some slack. You can't beat yourself up. Chemo has a lot of cognitive side effects. Sometimes you really should find an advocate. Maybe it's not a family member, but somebody who can speak on your behalf, particularly if you're an introvert and you're afraid to talk to a doctor. Many patients are afraid that if they bring up some concerns to their physician, that they will cause that individual to, well, they're afraid that they're going to insult the physician. And then in some cases, they're afraid they won't get the best treatment.
Thank you for that. Now, of course, breast cancer, yes, first and foremost, it affects the individual that is diagnosed, but it has that ripple effect into their loved ones and their support system. How did you navigate the emotional impact of your diagnosis on your relationships, and what advice do you have for others in similar situations?
Well, with your spouse, you can pretty much tell everything. But I had young children at the time. I think they were 11 to 18. And you really have to couch what you share with them based on what you think they can absorb and not instill fear in them. In my case, the church that we were going to, my children had experienced the previous 6 years, the loss of seven of their friends' parents at different ages. So I had five kids in this private school. And so that's all they knew. Cancer means you're going to die. So when I sat down and shared with my children that I had this diagnosis, at a family meeting, my 11-year-old son sort of raised his hand and said, well, I just have one question. And he said, are you going to die? And I said, well, eventually, yes, absolutely. Highly unlikely from this. And he said, well, okay, then can I go down the street and play? Because I think that if I was going to die, he had to sit and wait and watch. But my other son, my 14-year-old son, held it up all summer. And then when I finished treatment and didn't die, because he didn't voice it, he was hospitalized for not a nervous breakdown, but just anxiety for about a week. So he had been holding all this in. So you have to really know your children in particular and family members of what they can and cannot handle. I mean, I'm trying to take care of myself. I actually tried to pretend everything was okay. I am going to treatment and I'll be back in about 2 hours, but no big deal. But maybe I should have tried to do more to open up. And I think actually now there's children's support groups, which is really great. And there's a camp for kids whose parents have cancer called Camp Kesem. And there's some also these serious fun camps. And I think that's where those kids can go. And then they're, if that's their support group, there's the other kids are there whose parents have cancer. And so now they can talk about it. I will say that when kids tell other kids about their parents' cancer, the kids are scared, people back away from you. And that can be a challenge. I find that when you have a serious health diagnosis, one of two things happen. People come alongside with like lasagna.
Yeah.
Or you don't hear from them because it scares them. In that case, you have to give a lot of grace to the ones that back away and a lot of gratitude to those who come
support
along
and stay.
Yeah.
How have you seen breast cancer awareness shift in terms of the help, education, and support available now as opposed to when you were first diagnosed and when you first started the Pink Fund?
So when I was diagnosed, we had VHS tapes. And they put me in a room, a stark white room with a little TV, and they plug in this VHS tape that tells me everything that I'm going to experience. I'm like, great. There was no question. There was nobody with me in the room. There was very little internet. I mean, 2005 was sort of when Facebook was just getting going, right? So there was nothing like there is now. And now, thanks to all the nonprofits that have sprung up for not only breast cancer, but all kinds of disease states, and pharmaceutical companies and others who have helped to fund these nonprofits to create really patient-focused education, that has changed the landscape of what I would call the psychosocial, financial, physical support. Pfizer has an amazing program, and we have a meeting next week. It's called POPSI, and I hate acronyms, and so I'm going to mess this up, and I can try to look it up on my phone. But it's where they have advocates come in and look at all the patient-facing collateral materials and education, whether it's paper or digital, that they're delivering to patients about cancer, whether it's breast cancer or any kind of cancer. And so I think this is a lovely thing because we get to come in and say, well, that doesn't resonate with me, and don't use acronyms with patients. They don't know what that means. But but the efforts on the pharmaceutical companies, I would say that are doing a really good job of trying to reach out to patients. All of them have strong patient advocates on their employed by them who spend a lot of time working in the nonprofit space, helping to get this information to patients either directly through the pharmaceutical company or via a program that they create with the nonprofit. So now there is lots of credible information out there. And so that's the thing, credible, not wackadoo stuff. So,
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I would say that's a huge change.
So speaking of credible information versus wackadoo information, what, in your opinion, are the top three misconceptions and stigmas surrounding the disease, and how do you address and challenge these misconceptions?
One, I think the first one is that men don't get breast cancer, and they do. So there is the Male Breast Cancer Alliance headed by Sherry Ambrose, okay. And she's doing a fantastic job globally. So I think that's a big one, because by the time a male gets tested for breast cancer, he often has a very advanced disease, and most often it's fat because they don't have a lot of fat on their breasts for the tumors to grow. I mean, it can get into the other body parts pretty quickly. So that's number one, that men can get breast cancer. Number two, 40-some thousand women or more are dying of this disease every year in the United States. So while there's this early detection saves lives, it does. But on the other hand, some people are diagnosed with metastatic, which is known as stage four disease, what they call de novo, which means right out of the gate, first diagnosis. So that's the other one. And I think those are the two key, is that men get breast cancer and there's still a high mortality rate. But here's the other one. This is the big one. The underrepresented, underserved populations of Black, Latina, Indigenous peoples, Asians, Hispanics are dying at higher rates.
Wow.
And so we need to be casting a much wider net when we're engaging in clinical trials. We need to make it possible for these underserved, underrepresented communities to be part of clinical trials to make sure that some of these drugs work for everybody.
Absolutely.
So I would say that's the other part. Somewhere between 41 and 42% of women of color have a higher mortality rate with breast cancer.
Jesus.
And some of that is a result of what I would call social determinants of health. They're not getting screened. They're not educated. And then other is the part of they don't have money. They can't afford to leave their hourly job at, let's say, Target
to go to their appointments. Yeah, for sure. And so with that being said around detection and screenings, and obviously early detection and regular screenings are vital in combating breast cancer, but how do you encourage and educate others about the importance of self-examination, screenings, seeking medical attention for any concerning symptoms?
There's a big dialogue around self-exam because many people feel like women don't know how to do it correctly, which we don't. But I still believe there's a little thing out there called feel it on the first, check your breasts on the first of every month. There's a lot of education around screenings. Right now, under the Affordable Care Act, your annual mammogram doesn't cost you anything. It's guaranteed. So there's no reason not to get it. But the larger challenge becomes if the mammogram comes back with a positive result or a suspicious mass, the follow-up tests are not covered. So the follow-up MRIs and ultrasounds are not covered, and those can range between $150 and $500. So now, right away, those underrepresented, underserved people are not getting those tests.
Yeah.
They can't afford it. So that probably contributes to the higher mortality rate. So that's a big one right now. We're, as advocates, we're working to get that changed because it is covered for prostate cancer and lung, those follow-up screenings. Why it's not covered for breast, I don't know. As advocates, we're working nationally to change that.
And so how do you engage in the larger conversation around that and breast cancer beyond awareness campaigns? How do we overcome this problem, or how do we start to combat it?
So I have to give some kudos to Komen, because Komen really was one of the first to get women out of their homes. I mean, there was so much shame around breast cancer because until the late 90s, I mean, the whole thing was Dr. Susan Lover recently passed away, and she was an amazing advocate for breast cancer. And her book is known as the Bible for breast cancer. She talked about, I think she called it slash, burn, and kill. I mean, she said the treatments were so toxic. But Komen got all these women out in the streets, the Race for the Cure, walking, pinked out, celebrating. And that really started an awareness campaign. So it removed the shame from the disease, but started awareness. But there's not enough education out there until you need it. There's some public health initiatives in Michigan. The Michigan Department of Public Health has an amazing, robust website that they received money. I believe it was from the Department of Defense. I could be wrong. Maybe it was this. Oh, see, I'm going to mess this up. National Institutes of Health. But they have a really great website. I can follow up with that with you. But again, there's a lot of information out there, but you don't necessarily use it until you need it. And then sometimes it's a little late.
Now, back to, I want to talk a little bit about the stats you had mentioned, 41%. And we're talking about male breast cancer as well. So leads into these next couple of questions. I read that female breast cancer has now surpassed lung cancer as the most commonly diagnosed cancer. An estimated 2.2 million new cases of breast cancer were diagnosed in women across the world in 2020. Those numbers are horrifying and staggering. So what are a couple of tips you could provide in order to help with early detection and risk reduction?
Well, I think that's changed because people don't smoke cigarettes anymore like they used to, right?
Right.
So over the last 50 years, that has changed. I mean, lung cancer is not always the result of behavioral choices, but most often can
right.
be. Breast cancer can be the result of behavioral choices as well, particularly if you are overweight. That's an indication. When we think about our breasts, they're really, they're fat cells, they're milk glands, and they're blood vessels primarily. So the heavier you are, that cancer can hide out in those places, and your body doesn't shed the toxins. So I have to say right away, I'm not a physician.
Yeah.
And so I can't give any medical advice, but regular exercise, maintaining a within, I don't know, what is normal range of weight, and positivity can help. But the other thing, I think there's a misconception that there's a high rate of genetic predisposition when the research tells us it's really about 8 to 10% of breast cancers are genetically driven. However, we are still uncovering other gene expressions, they're called, that when combined with, you know, if you have a whole genetic done, often this will show that we have some of this gene and some of that and some of that. And while you don't have maybe the big BRCA1 or 2 genes, the other genes together would put you at risk.
Right.
So I would think that if you have any family history of any cancer at all, and even if it's on the male side, because we've seen, oh, well, it doesn't just come through the female side, breast cancer. It can come from the male side. So I would think if you have any of that genetic sequencing would be really important, getting that testing done. You were globally, it's hard because we're talking about third world nations. I mean, there's just not medical care. But if somebody there may have breast cancer, they could have an ulcerated breast. So in the U.S., we're fortunate that our annual physical is also covered under the Affordable Care Act. And so your primary care physician is really that first point of contact that should be driving the education around all your health, the potential issues, including getting that annual mammogram. And now with our electronic medical records, is you get little announcements, alerts, like if you schedule your mammogram. So I think the EMRs are really helping to change how we do things maybe earlier. But again, people often ignore their health symptoms and you can't control those behaviors. All the education in the world is not going to overcome somebody's fear of a potential diagnosis or fear of physicians or mistrust. So in the communities of color, particularly the Black community, there's such huge mistrust. And I just read yesterday, I think, that there was a final settlement for Henrietta Lacks' family, who they took her cells and used them in wonderful ways, but just was not something that she agreed to. And they've made millions and millions of dollars after some of the research that they've done, probably billions. And I didn't get to how much the family received for that egregious act, but now that doesn't happen as far as I know. So there's a lot of mistrust.
Now, I want to get back to the male breast cancer. Obviously, I would think that the comparatively speaking, if you can even compare, the numbers pale for men living with breast cancer versus women, of course. I'm curious, though, as to how often you see or hear of cases where men are living with breast cancer.
So we've helped some men. I think we've helped about 10 men. We're working with the Male Breast Cancer Alliance to help educate around that. And so November is Men's Health Month. Right. So we'll be pushing out our awareness campaign with men that month. Okay. As I mentioned earlier, Sherry Ambrose is doing a lot globally with education and traveling. The incidence in the U.S. is about less than 1% of the total diagnoses of women. So this year, I think it's 2023, I think there are like 2,100 men are expected to be diagnosed over, like, there's 264,000 women.
Wow.
That's why, I mean, they just don't think about it.
Well, I think there's also a stigma of shame around it, too, for men, mm-hmm. as to coming forward and speaking about it, which would also affect the numbers, I would think, a little bit. I mean, again, nowhere near what women are dealing with, but I would think that stigma and shame has an effect on the numbers as well.
I think that's particularly true, but I do feel like the work of the Male Breast Cancer Alliance is going to help change that, just like Komen got women out of their homes and into the streets.
What keeps you motivated and determined to fight for breast cancer awareness and support? What message do you have for those who may feel overwhelmed or unsure about getting involved in advocacy themselves?
Well, first of all, the path of how you handle your disease is very individual, and nobody should feel like they have to be an advocate. They should be an advocate for themselves, first and foremost. I mean, you are your best advocate. And as I said earlier, if you're not able to be an advocate for yourself, you need to find some badass male or female friend who's going to speak on your behalf and go to appointments with you and ask questions that you're too afraid to ask. So my first thing was, not everybody has to be an advocate, but you have to be a self-advocate. Some of the best advocacy organizations are those that you're going to join when you're in treatment and you meet all these other people. I would say that we have the ability to change things for the good when we come together and advocate for legislative changes. For example, I sit on the board of the National Breast Cancer Coalition out of Washington, D.C., and we are advocating for a change with patients with metastatic breast cancer to change the wait period to receive Social Security disability. Right now, there's a very long wait period. You can be approved, but you have to wait months and months without showing any working income. Well, who can live without having any working income, right? Particularly if you don't have any savings. So I understand in part why that is in place now, but it places women and families in a very difficult position. So that's where there's work being done by advocates from all over the country coming together in D.C. And we have Lobby Day in May where we go, we talk about this and why it should be changed. Another thing that happens is this organization called Touch the Breast Cancer Alliance, Black Breast Cancer Alliance, is working very hard to educate women about why clinical trials might be a great option for them and why they should enroll. And they're doing just an outstanding job. Recently, I got involved in another form of advocacy around what's a breast reconstruction issue, which, so in breast reconstruction, you can either have implants, you can have what they call tram flaps, but there's another procedure called the deep flap where they take fat from your stomach and your belly and the blood vessels and everything and move it up to your breast and create really naturally appearing, feeling breasts. And the outcome for that surgery long term is better than implants, which can cause autoimmune diseases, which can shift and move, which have been recalled. So the Centers for Medicare, they wanted to change the coding on this so that the deep flap wasn't covered. It's a very expensive surgery. And the out-of-pocket, if this is not covered by your insurance, which is, by the way, guaranteed as part of CURE. It didn't used to be. Reconstruction was not covered for a number of years. But now it's like making women whole again, whatever they choose. But if right now, the way they're wanting to change the coding is that the deep flap would not be covered. So as advocates, I wrote a blog called Deeply Disturbed. And all of us have come together in ways that actually the Center for Medicaid Services are looking at this again. So they're giving it a second look. And that's where advocates got really powerful, wrote op-eds, posted on social channels.
That's incredible.
Right. So we as advocates have an opportunity to make a real difference. And I think that's really important. We had a situation some years ago where a health insurer that I won't name declined to accept our payment, that health insurance premium, for reasons I believe that if they killed that premium for that person, they wouldn't have to pay the hundreds of thousands of dollars for treatment. So I went up to Lansing, and the claim was that they couldn't accept the payment from a third party unless it was HIV or Hep C. So unless it was a public, and I don't even know why, unless it was a public health issue. So I went up to Lansing here in Michigan, where our capital is, and met with the Democratic, she's Democratic head of the House, and said, I need this changed. Yeah. And she said, well, I think we can do this through diplomacy. I said, well, I want to do it through legislation. She said, well, let's try diplomacy. So I always say I'm a disruptor, not much of a diplomat. But anyway, I was like, okay, I'll go for it. So she got it changed through diplomacy. But ultimately, that needs to be changed through legislation. We just had a situation where we paid a dental premium. Your teeth are really affected by chemotherapy. And you can have very significant tooth loss and dental issues. And we paid this dental premium and it was declined. Again, you're a third party. We don't have to accept it. So there again, advocacy on that. We're working on that. If our organization was larger and we had more financial resources, we might get more engaged in advocacy and lobbying. But we can do this now through other organizations without having to fund it through Pink Fund. And it's just as effective.
Well, I mean, the more people you get involved, the louder the voice is. So that's the key, right, is bringing more and more people on board with the advocacy work to have a louder voice and to stand united. Because the more people you get involved, they can't deny if the voice is so loud.
You are the voters, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is. So yeah. I've seen advocacy make a lot of great positive change.
Looking towards the future of the Pink Fund, Molly, what are your aspirations and goals for the company, and how do you hope to make a lasting impact on the lives of those affected by breast cancer?
So there's this thing called founder syndrome, where the founder doesn't want to leave. So we have a strategy in mind with a timetable and a plan in place. Right now, I have an emergency successor. So should I win the lottery and quit or do something stupid and get fired or, I don't know, run for president. I've been thinking about that. We have a plan in place for someone to step in while the board would then. The problem that the Pink Fund addresses is not a problem that is solvable. It's a problem that is bridged. There is not enough money in the way our health system is set up to completely solve this problem. So we are going to be needed, as are other organizations in the space who collaborate, but provide additional means of support. One of the things we're doing is we're building a larger board of directors. So we just had our board meeting Monday night, and we decided to increase our board from 7 to 15. And that will be done over the next 3 to 5 years, very strategically. That was one thing we'd like to do. Another thing we're considering is how do we provide financial support for patients who cannot participate in clinical trials because of financial barriers? So we're looking at that, providing not only navigation around that maybe, but do we create a program that would provide, we can't do reimbursement. That's what's really interesting. People who need to be in a clinical trial, they don't have the cash up front to travel to the trial site, to leave work, to pay for accommodations. So we're sorting through that. So that's kind of a future plan. We want to do much more on some educational pieces on how to advocate for yourself, around what questions to ask, around getting financial help. And then my big goal is that I want a national charity checkout program that will build significant revenue for the organization that will twofold fund the mission, allow us to help more people. I think I mentioned earlier that we have had a 53% increase in requests for help, which means we needed more than double our budget. So our current budget is $2.4 million. We need to get really to $5 million to meet that need. And that's this year.
Wow.
I don't know how it's going to increase next year. And then we need to build a very significant, I'd like to build a $25 million endowment account, ultimately to take 5% of that account every year. And that would be designed to actually fund the overhead of the mission so that then, you know, 100% of the donor dollar goes to helping provide financial aid for these patients and their families. And I'd like to have that done in the next 5 years.
Lots of big goals and lots in the works. I think it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, right, the work you're doing.
By 2028, see, in 5 years, then I run for president.
There you go. Yeah. Molly for president. You heard it here first, everyone. Molly McDonald for president. I love it. Molly, what lights you up or is the most rewarding thing about the work that you do?
The thank you notes from the patients and their families. They're really amazing. Some of them, they told us that they had their surgery, but they weren't going to have the chemotherapy until we paid their house for 3 months. And then they told their doctor they could get the chemo. So that was a big one.
Yeah.
We had a note a couple of weeks ago from a woman we helped who did pass away. And her husband said that because of the help that we provided to their family, that he was able to spend the last months of her life with her. And he then has named us as the beneficiary of his life insurance policy.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That is incredible.
So the notes that say, I'm able to sleep through the night. I'm crying happy tears for the first time in months. Because of your help, I can buy strawberries. Because that was like a little thing. So the psychosocial, the mental health, I mean, the things that we're doing is not just this financial support. It really rolls out into other areas of the patient's lives and their families.
The mental health factor alone.
Big. Yeah.
Yeah, that's massive. Well, I think it's beautiful, Molly. What do you think your unique skill set or superpower is that's helped you become successful?
Well, I think I'm resilient. I think my parents taught me that. I grew up well off, but I was never indulged financially. So I had to work for certain things. And when I moved in with my boyfriend, when I was pursuing a master's degree at the University of Michigan in journalism, my parents called me up and said, so we see you're making all the adult decisions. And I said, yeah, what do you mean? And they said, well, you're going to get all the adult responsibility. I'm like, well, what does that mean? They said, well, we're not paying for your schooling anymore. I said, okay. And we're taking the car back. And I said, okay. And I wasn't mad at them. I'm like, this made sense. They said, you are not living according to our moral code. You're an adult. You're 25. You can do all this. And I went out and I got 3 part-time jobs, ended up doing 2 of them. And then I got a loan and a grant. So I think resilience, or just, you know, I can do this. I can take care of it. I don't blame somebody else for a decision that they've made. Tenacity, self-belief, faith. When I had to leave my marriage very quickly with my 5 children, I had no money. I had literally no money and I didn't know what was going to happen. But I had this Bible verse that really I clung to, which was Jeremiah. It's 10. See, I'm really not good. I'm really bad Christian. I don't like go around spouting Bible verses. But anyways, Jeremiah 10:11, I think it was, for I know the plans I have for you, say the Lord, plans to prosper you, give you hope and a future. And so I kept saying that there's a future for me. And I just never thought it would be in the nonprofit space. And so I always say at the end, in losing everything I thought had value, which was just stuff, I found what really does. And it's a life of service. So on my emails, there's this little Winston Churchill quote that says, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give.
I love that. And that, I mean, really, when you think about it, that's really why we're all here, is to be in and of service to one another. That's our purpose. Well, that's a big part of our purpose.
Hopefully some of us feel that way, but there's some people who are, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
But I will say that my greatest joy comes from helping others. There was back in my big old life where I had a housekeeper and a gardener and everything was delivered and a nanny. I had a neighbor across the street who was much wealthier than we were. And her husband had been chairman of the board of McKenzie Worldwide, and they had homes all over the place. And I observed Susie, and she would walk into any, almost any room. And after saying her pleasantries, the first thing she would say, "How can I help?" And so I started practicing that. I don't even know why, but I thought, I saw how it changed the room. She was this woman whose husband had been chief of staff in the White House for Jimmy Carter for a period of time.
Wow.
Yeah. So she had been exposed. They had a home in Paris across the street from the Eiffel Tower, and a chalet in Switzerland, and another home in Connecticut. But Susie was all about helping and minimizing their wealth and all the awards that her husband had received and how they lived. She minimized that to really help other people. So that was, how can I help? I started practicing that. And then I think early in my life, I would walk in and I would be like, here I am, I'm here. And I switched that to there you are. So I'd been a reporter, and really as a reporter, there you are is all about learning your story. Tell me more about you. And the other thing that happened for me that really changed me is that when we had to leave our life, it was really hard. And I felt I was so invested in my family of origin, my private school education, my clothes, my cars, my vacations, my jewelry, my art. I mean, all this stuff that I felt made me who I was. And then it was gone. All of it was gone. I mean, the stuff was gone. And I had a really hard time finding who I was. And I had a really hard time being happy for other people for a while. All my former, well, they were still my friends at the time, but their trips to Europe and their homes all over the place and their new clothes and whatever it was. And I decided to practice being happy for them. Instead of being jealous or feeling like I got gypped, I started practicing, oh, tell me more about that. That sounds so great. Show me some pictures or whatever. I'm so happy for you. And then that became genuine. So I would say those three things, you know, how can I help, there you are, and truly be happy for other people, even when they have things that you think you want or should have, but don't, because that's where the joy comes from.
Yeah.
When you're jealous and angry and feel like you don't have what you deserve, that can make you physically sick.
That's a shitty energy to carry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I tell those three things. And then my son, we have this little granddaughter, and she was whining about something the other day. And my son said something that I think, I really hope, this was probably the biggest gift he's ever given me. He said, you know, Charlotte, when Mimi started her organization, and then he went into the story about how it was taken from me, and he said to her, and do you know what she did? She started over. And she didn't let that stop her. And I thought, wow, this is probably the best lesson I've ever given to my son. And I didn't know I did.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So I think that's my legacy.
I love it. Speaking of success, Molly, how do you define that word? What does the word success mean to you?
Well, I think it goes back to that Winston Churchill quote. We make a living by what we get. It's not about the money or the stuff. It's about what you give back, what you give out. And sometimes, you know, I'm giving out money, but I'm not giving out my money. It's all these fabulous donors who help us and our partners. I think success to me is just knowing you helped somebody. Mm-hmm. But I also want to say that for people who are extremely wealthy and spend a lot of money, I always tell people when they purchase whatever that thing is, there's a whole line of people behind that brought that product to market.
Yep.
And so they're keeping those people in groceries and roofs over their heads. And so we should not disparage the wealthy for the way they spend their money.
Very true. What would you say is one of the most important things you've learned in your life? And what was your life like before you learned it? And what was your life like after learning it?
I was really self-absorbed and self-important probably until I had to leave my marriage. I was 46 at the time. So it was pretty much all about me. I used to think that if people would just be more like me, their life would be perfect. Like I had it all together. Why wouldn't you want to be like me? There's a quote that the author Anne Lamott has in one of her books that said something like, if people would just listen to me and do what I say, their lives would be so much better and so would mine, because I wouldn't have to worry about their bad choices or something like that. So I always talk about my never to be humble opinion. Now I've learned to not give my opinion unless somebody asks. I'll say, are you interested in what I think about this, before just telling them they're full of shit. And I will tell you the other thing, I was make a terrible therapist. Terrible. I'd be a terrible therapist because I would be listening to these people whining about the same thing over and over again. And I would just want to think in my head, get your effing shit together. Stop whining. But again, the lesson really goes back to, for me, it's not about the stuff. We don't take it with us. I think being at the bedside of both my parents when they passed away was the most amazing miracle I've ever witnessed. It's, to me, a greater miracle than birth, because the essence of that individual is truly gone. And everything that we have associated with that individual is all about how they appear, what they wear, how they speak, what they surround themselves with. It's all the trappings of the physical world. And then it's empty. So to have had the privilege of witnessing that was a very different experience than seeing a body laid out in a coffin. And I just think that we can enjoy all our stuff, but the real joy in life is really about serving others in some capacity. And I'll give an example. In my neighborhood, somebody said to me one day, I'm not doing really much. I don't do what you do. I mean, and then I realized that some people are intimidated by what I do because it makes them feel less. So she said, well, all I'm doing is I go to the hospital once a week and I push people around in the wheelchair to their appointments. And I said, well, how do you know that you're not the safest person they're with that day? How do you know they can't maybe tell their family that they're scared and they're scared of the doctors and you're chatting them up on the way to wherever, the friendly face? You don't know what you're doing for that person. Yeah. And it's not about the quantity of what we do. It's really about the quality, maybe the amount of time or the investment of sitting with somebody when they're going through a tough time. You don't have to go out raising $1 million to pay somebody's bills.
Absolutely.
Comparison is the thief of joy.
Yes, for sure.
I don't want people to do that.
That's a
beautiful. Although I compare myself a lot to other people. I still do.
Molly, what does the word empowerment mean to you?
I think empowerment comes from within. I don't think you can be encouraged externally, which can result in internal empowerment. But this to me would go back to maybe coaching or other external messages you're getting from people. I mean, I think that can lead you to feel more empowered, but I think you have to find it within yourself. Yeah. I don't know if that's a very good answer.
No, that's perfect. That's your definition. That's beautiful. Okay, we're going to jump into a little rapid fire section. So the next grouping of questions just be 1, 2, 3 word answer type thing, okay?
I'm not good with that, but I'll try.
You can do it. I know okay. You can.
All right.
How would you describe yourself in one word?
Resilient.
If you could teach the world one thing, what would it be?
Love.
What's one thing you want but cannot buy with money?
Oh my gosh. I already have it.
And what is it?
Service.
If you were writing your autobiography, what would the title be?
Now that my topless dancing career is over.
That is brilliant.
That's not one word, though. Sorry.
No. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 word type thing. That's okay. I love that title. That is brilliant. If you could be remembered for one thing, Molly, what would it be?
I tried.
What is one thing you love about yourself that is not related to your physical appearance?
I'm not loving my physical appearance so much anymore. It's really hard to get old. My mind.
Beautiful. That concludes our rapid fire section. Now back to our regularly scheduled program. What is something...
Can I just interrupt? I found out what POPSI means.
Oh, okay.
Okay, hold on a minute. I just hit it. Okay, it's Pfizer Oncology Patient Centricity Ecosystem.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Which is a lot. I don't know what that means.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah.
What is something surprising you've learned about yourself in the last year, Molly?
That I'm a better grandmother than I was a mother.
That's great.
I think a lot of grandmothers say that. I think it's like you get a second chance. You screw up with the first group. They come around.
That's quite a revelation.
Yeah, it makes me sad.
Well, I'm sure if you asked your kids, they wouldn't see it that way.
I think they agree.
Really?
Yeah, I think they agree. I mean, we went through such a challenging time. I was really stressed out when I had to leave and take care of them. I think they think I'm great now. But they've forgiven me for some of my... I would have to say I was not suited to raise 5 children on my own.
Well, that's a huge responsibility for anyone to have to raise 5 kids on your own. I mean, and then you factor in the fact that you later on went through breast cancer and that's a lot on anybody. So I think.
But I had a foreshadowing of that. I remember babysitting. This is really funny. There was this Catholic family in Grosse Pointe, and I remember babysitting. I didn't like babysitting, but anyway, I was babysitting and she had 5 kids and I'm holding this baby and it's crying and I'm calling my mother and she wants to know if it's a hungry cry or a wet cry or a tired cry. I'm like, how the hell do I know? I'm like, I don't know what this is. And I remember thinking, who should have 5 children? This is terrible. And then I did, But I was blessed to have them. I mean, each of my children are precious to me, and I feel very sad about the changes in their lifestyle that affected their childhood. But in the end, I think their witness to how I overcame what happened will serve them well in the future.
There you go. And that's it right there. Molly, what is your why?
My why? This goes back to my faith. My why is, well done, my good and faithful servant.
If you had the opportunity to sit down and have a one-hour conversation with one woman, any woman in the world, who would it be and why?
Probably Malala Yousaf, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, really overcame a lot, had to forgive a lot of people. I think of in the world that would be. I'd also like to talk to Marie Antoinette and ask her why she was such a bitch. What do you mean, let them eat cake? That was mean.
All right. If you could go back, Molly, and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that piece of advice be?
Slow down. You move too fast.
Lastly, if you were to deliver your last 30-second speech to the world, your tribe, your corner of the world, your people, what would that last 30 seconds sound like? What words of wisdom would you impart?
What I've already said, in losing everything I thought had value, I found what really does, a life of service. And in the words of Winston Churchill, we make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give.
Beautifully said. Molly, thank you so very much for the beautiful work that you do, the beautiful light you put out into the world through that work. It is so necessary and beautiful. Thank you for taking and making the time to be here with me today to share your story, your journey. You are an incredibly inspirational, beautiful human being, woman, and soul. I appreciate you, and I'm so grateful to be connected to you and to have you as a member of the Empowerography community. Thank you for sharing today. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you, and I hope your listeners will laugh and get something from this of value to them.
I'm sure they will. Once again, my name is Brad Walsh, host of your Empowerography podcast. Today, my guest has been Molly McDonald. She is the founder of The Pink Fund, a contributing writer for Breast Cancer Wellness Magazine, a passionate patient advocate, a keynote speaker, and last, but certainly not least, a mother. Molly, thank you so much. I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. If you haven't yet, please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, and share with all your friends. You can find me at viseuphoria.ca and follow me on Instagram at Empowerography Podcast and on Facebook at Empowerography. Please join me next time for another inspirational story from yet another amazing woman.